From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's still a tough economy, but this time of year people are looking to spend. The figures for the Black Friday weekend are in, and it turns out nearly 200 million people visited stores or websites and spent around $52 billion. And what were they buying? The usual stuff, of course, electronics and toys and shoes, but also guns. Yep, the FBI reports a record-breaking number of guns were sold on Black Friday. We cannot help you if you're looking for firearms, but let's say your gift idea is a book. If it's a book, we've got you covered. Today in the program, it's our annual holiday book show. Our group of local booksellers are here to give you suggestions for books as gifts this season. So grab a pen. We'll be back after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. If you own a bookstore, if your business is books, it's easy to make a suggestion to a customer about a title you figure they might like. But let's say someone is asking you to make a suggestion for a larger audience, and not just that, but to narrow it down to your top books for the year. It's hard to do. That's why this time of year our experts always come in with stacks of titles to offer as gift ideas for the season. And it usually happens they don't get to a good number of the books they've brought along, but we're going to do our best today. It's our annual holiday book show today. Our group of local booksellers are with us. These are people who are voracious readers with really great taste in books. So you're going to need a pen for the next hour. If you have questions or comments, you can call us, 801-585-WEST. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Ken Sanders is back with us, the owner of Ken Sanders Rare Books in downtown Salt Lake City on 2nd East. And 2nd South, about that address. I won't give you the exact address. I'll give it to you later. Ken, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Doug.
Catherine Weller is the new book buyer for Sam Weller Zion Bookstore on Main Street, at least Main Street for now, in downtown Salt Lake City. And Catherine, welcome back.
Thanks, Doug.
Betsy Burton owns the King's English Bookshop at 15th and 15th in Salt Lake City. And Betsy, welcome back to you.
Thank you, Doug.
So I always ask this question, and I'll do it again. As you reflect back on the past year, good year for books, Betsy Burton?
It's been a good year for books. You know, the sort of elephant in the living room is, are e-books going to impact the book market?
Yeah.
And so far what's happened is e-book sales do exist. They're on the rise, but book sales are on the rise too. So maybe it means people are reading more. And then for independent bookstores, of course, the crucial thing is to let the public know that we can actually sell ebooks at the same price that the monster Amazon can. So it's a really interesting time in our lives, I think, to try to figure out how to join this market and still maintain our absolute devotion and love for the real book, which is why we're all here.
Mm-hmm. Kat, what do you think? You guys worried, obviously, in some ways?
You know, 3-4 years ago, I was extremely concerned, and I spent a lot of time thinking about how am I going to get into this market? How am I going to get into this market? It's the ebooks are coming. There's no doubt about it. And now that they're here, I'm not quite as worried because it's not the elephant under the carpet anymore. We can see it. We can see ways to deal with it. We can move on towards the future and work with our partners in publishing and our partners in, say, Used and Rare to really keep the physical object alive and valued, as well as valuing the ease of use and the price component that goes with an e-reader. The biggest thing I think about this year is the tail end of this year has had some just standout books, and that makes all the difference in the world.
Yeah, I was going to say that's the thing, right?
Yeah, it is.
Always.
Because it's about, in the end, it's about content.
It is.
Yeah. And you can't sell what ain't there.
What are you saying, Mr. Sanders?
E-books, SME books. I don't care about e-books. I don't mean to express hostility towards them, Doug, but they don't exist for me and they don't exist for large numbers of my generation. And I've bought my own children Kindles in the past, though I have no love for Amazon or other online retailers. And I don't fear them. I'm not afraid of them. I simply don't care about them. Honestly, they don't exist for me. And to me, it's still all about the book, and I've said this many times before, the book is never going to die. It's being transmuted. Authors are coming up with new clever ways of doing books, new book publishing, although in a metamorphosis like we've never seen. There's little things coming out of it, and new ways of writing and interpreting and seeing things. And I embrace it all, but I don't care about ebooks. There's plenty of ink on paper. We just published a new title that I'll talk about later. And when the printer delivered all those books, we actually stuffed them all in my car to take them to the warehouse. And driving home with my daughter that night, Melissa says, "What's that smell in here?" And it's like, honey, that's ink on paper.
So, Kat, you referenced this, but in terms of books themselves, the quality of books, you guys are pretty excited for this year?
The content is incredible. Some of the best fiction in remembered history is out this year, and some of the best nonfiction. But the other really interesting thing is publishers are starting to really pay attention to the physical book again, which they had kind of ceased to do, the deckled edges of pages and the print and the font and all of that creating beauty to make people pay attention to books is happening again this year.
Typography and design and acid-free paper. See, and speaking of, acid-free papers and formats on which ideas and culture and writing will exist, institutions and libraries are really struggling with what is a digital archive? How do we take care of it? How do we maintain it? And like 8-track tapes or floppy disks or any one of 100 things, how are we going to ensure access for the future? And if Amazon, in the famous case of downloading and then deleting 1984 books, how do we know? I mean,
is that right?
Yes.
That is right.
Remember really what they can give to you, Doug, they take away. But like the Jasper Ford Thursday Next novels, how do we know that digital text that we're reading is the one the author wrote? Who's going to supervise that? Who's going to edit these things?
Well, we never know that with print copy either. It's just that there's more quality control, I think, with print and more assurance because there's something permanent. What concerns me is transportability of files. You mentioned 8-track tapes and cassettes. It's what happens when the next digital format comes along. What happens when your device crashes? What happens when the mainframe of the digital archives crashes? There better be a physical copy somewhere. Yeah. There's a place for physical copies. We're seeing that with vinyl now. Vinyl is resurging. It's because people are valuing what vinyl gives them. And it's not just holding it in your hand, but that's part of it. Please remember, an electronic copy is a license. It is not ownership.
An original Gutenberg's Bible is pretty tough to find, but you can still read
That's right.
Yep. Right.
They're still out there.
This is a perfected format here.
Yeah.
It's great.
All right. Well, let's jump in because we've got a lot to get to. And Ken Sanders, we're going to start with you.
Well, speaking of richness of new book publishing locally, I think we're continuing in the 21st century just this rich vein of local and Western and regional and Mormon and Gentile history. And it's just – there's just great stuff coming along. There are great authors writing in the field. I just think it's a real renaissance for local, cultural, and regional history. John Sillitoe and John McCormick have just issued a new History of Utah Radicalism, Startling, Socialistic, and Decidedly Revolutionary. And it's the whole history, particularly of socialism, that dread S word, in Utah culture. And just one tidbit from the book, in the early 1900s, the city of Murray, Utah, ran and elected an entire socialist party. Mayor, city council, everything, and they were even re-elected right here in the Valley of the Great Salt Lake. It's a great read and to a little known. It's the first ever full-length history of radicalism and socialism right here in Utah.
Wow.
there is, for the first time since Gibbs Smith's college thesis of 40 years ago, there's a brand new, in fact, two new books out on Joe Hill, one locally published by a local attorney called Pie in the Sky, How Joe Hill's Lawyers Lost His Case, Got Him Shot, and Were Disbarred. So I don't believe the author leaves any headroom for his stance on the subject. The other Joe Hill book is William Adler's, and I know you had him on the show, the brilliant new book, the first new full-length history ever since Gibbs Smith, of The Man Who Never Died, The Life, Times, and Legacy of Joe Hill, American Labor Icon. And there's a lot of new information to help a new generation of people access what the IWW was, why they existed, their attempts to organize against big labor and big government, which really, really echoes right now in the whole Occupy movements that are sweeping the country.
Yeah,
and just very quickly to finish the local history, Bones in the Well is the Hans Mill Massacre, 1838, a documentary history on early Mormon history, and a new biography of Parley Pratt, the Apostle Paul of Mormonism, and finally The Fire in the Pasture, 21st Century Mormon Poets, which is an excellent anthology of some real cutting-edge local poetry.
Great. I should mention these are all online, by the way. We'll try to have you guys read the titles as we go, but you can find them online. Great. Ken, thanks. Okay, Catherine.
All right. We've all referenced nonfiction, and this has been a great, great year for nonfiction and a wonderful year for really big, bulky, old-fashioned nonfiction. I'm not talking narrow histories or memoirs here. Big, sweeping histories and very full biographies of significant characters. So it's been a delight for a nonfiction reader. The first one I'll mention is Rome, A Cultural and Visual and Personal History by Robert Hughes. Robert Hughes is an art historian, and he is a man who doesn't suffer fools at all, never much less likely. He has a very in-your-face and somewhat controversial writing style, but his love of Rome, his passion for the history of it, his knowledge is displayed in the second half of the book is just impeccable. First half of the book's a little dicey. If you are a classicist, you will take issue with some of the errors that should have been caught by editing. It's really a darn shame, and I'm hoping they'll clean it up in the paperback. Huh. But that said, the writing and the history is good enough that people who are historians or who like to read history will enjoy it anyway. And that's Rome by Robert Hughes. Great. The next one is by Robert Massey, one of the great biographers of Russian figures. His book, Peter the Great, was one of the books that sent me to college as a Russian major.
Is that right?
Yes, it is. It is. And that and a couple others. And he came out with a book this year on Catherine the Great, who married the grandson of Peter the Great. And she was a young German woman, minor royalty, who was imported to marry this really foul, nasty little ineffectual ruler, essentially. And what she was able to do once she seized power was absolutely fantastic. Her life is fascinating. She was a strong, intelligent woman in an age of enlightenment who struggled to bring that to her people. And Robert Massey really captures her yearning for learning, her yearning to continue to open Russia up to Europe and the ideas of the Enlightenment. And it captured her as a woman, too. His subtitle, Portrait of a Woman, is significant here because he is writing about her personal life, which was controversial at the time. You know, emperors can take all kinds of lovers, but not empresses. Nevertheless, she did.
Yeah.
And it's a wonderful full portrait of a very significant European leader.
Terrific. Say the title again.
Catherine the Great by Robert Massey. Okay. Lastly, Leningrad by Anna Reid. This is the best book on the siege of Leningrad that I have read since Harrison Salisbury's 900 Days War. Or 900 Days. It is well-researched. It is well-written. It is compelling. And for the modern reader, it is not the doorstop that Harrison Salisbury's book is. It is a bit more narrative in approach than Salisbury was, too. This is a more of a modern history for a modern reader, but nevertheless, it is solid. It covers all of the gruesome details and the will of a people to live 900 days without food or water and being shelled every single day. They ate the paste out of books. It was a horrible, tragic part of World War II, and this book captures it brilliantly. It's Leningrad by Anna Reid.
Great. Betsy Burton.
Well, I'm going to start, as I always do, with fiction, and I'm going to begin with my favorite book of the year, which is The Sense of an Ending by Julian Barnes. It's just an extraordinary book, and the thing that almost every reviewer has said, and it's the same thing that I said when I first presented this book, was you read it, and after turning the last page, you absolutely have to turn it over and start again. The reason is this is a book about three boys, begins with three boys in public school in England, which of course is private school, who are talking about life and death and sex and the usual concerns of adolescent boys. And they feature themselves as intellectuals. And then a young man comes to the school who truly is an intellectual. He has a stunningly intellectual mind and a kind of grasp of moral principles that is far beyond theirs. And he kind of upsets their balance. And they go on through school, and then they part ways, and they all go off to college. And our narrator, Tony, goes off to a second-rate school and gets a second. But the thing that he's most intent on in college is finding out about sex. So he starts a relationship with a like all young men everywhere. And he starts a relationship with a young woman, and it's a little dissatisfying. She'll cuddle and she'll share intimacies, but she won't go, quote, all the way. And not only that, she won't really bring him into her life in a full way. There is one weekend, however, when she takes him home. He has a very odd time there, a kind of unsettling encounter with her mother, doesn't understand her father. It's all very unsettling. Then he breaks up with her not long after this brilliant young man who came upon the three of them in college begins to have a relationship with Veronica. So this is all told in a kind of remembrance of things past. And then the main character is suddenly 65, and he's been happily married for many years and remembers in a very satisfied way this as part of his past. He gets a bequest for $500 from Veronica's mother and Adrian's diary, and he thinks to himself, why would Veronica's mother have Adrian's diary? And where is this diary? Because it isn't here. Veronica has it. This is a puzzle that sends him and us plummeting back in time, not so much to what happened, but to his memory of what happened and what memory really is and how we embellish and reinvent and defensively fool ourselves about memory. And I think we have a reading, and it comes at exactly that point where we're shifting from the forward narrative to the backward narrative.
Here it is, the actor Richard Morant reading from Julian Barnes' book, The Sense of an Ending.
Later on in life, you expect a bit of rest, don't you? You think you deserve it. I did, anyway. But then you begin to understand that the reward of merit is not life's business. Also, when you're young, you think you can predict the likely pains and bleaknesses that age might bring. You imagine yourself being lonely, divorced, widowed, children growing away from you, friends dying. You imagine the loss of status, the loss of desire and desirability. You may go further and consider your own approaching death, which, despite what company you may muster, can only be faced alone. But all this is looking ahead. What you fail to do is look ahead and then imagine yourself looking back from that future point, learning the new emotions that time brings, discovering, for example, that as the witnesses to your life diminish, there is less corroboration and therefore less certainty as to what you are or have been. Even if you have assiduously kept records in words, sound, pictures, you may find you have attended to the wrong kind of record-keeping. What was the line Adrian used to quote? History is that certainty produced at the point where the imperfections of memory meet the inadequacies of documentation.
It's Richard Morant reading from Julian Barnes' The Sense of an Ending. I can't wait to read it, Betsy. I have to say it's supposed to be an extraordinary piece. There was a great interview on NPR not so long ago with Julian Barnes, where it's my first encounter with the word deliquescent.
You encounter many words for the first time.
Is that right?
Don't they serve those at the delicatessen?
And I just want to add that this did win the new Booker Prize.
Yeah.
Deservedly so.
Yeah. That is Julian Barnes, The Sense of an Ending. So another to add to your list, we are doing our holiday book show today with our local group of experts, and we need to take a break. Back in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, it's our annual holiday book show. We gather our experts from local bookstores in Utah, ask them to make a list of the best books this year so you can find just the right gift. 801-585-WEST. If you have a question or a comment, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. If you're like most listeners, though, you just settle in with a pen and listen to these suggestions. So let's see. Okay, Ken. We're starting with you again, round two.
All right, Doug. Longtime local artist and teacher, now retired Frank Anthony Smith, he taught generations of students up here at the University of Utah, he quit painting many, many years ago and just draws now. And he said he's never been so happy in his life. And he has self-published a bricks and mortar, not an e-book, book of his drawings of some years now. I can't say the official title of the book
can't.
On the air.
I got that.
Because of the FCC regulations.
Right.
It's one of those infamous Lenny Bruce seven dirty words.
Yeah.
But the subtitle is finally a book about me. The book is as eccentric as Tony Smith is, and it has absolutely marvelous and incredibly and strange drawings.
Yeah.
It's really
wonderfully strange.
Strange, yes, yeah. Not bizarre strange.
All right, so
terrific book.
Yeah, say the subtitle again.
Finally, a book about me.
A book about me.
Coming on the heels of his enormously successful Genesis, the now French R. Crumb, Robert Crumb, Norton has come out with a book that looks like a 78 record. It has little cutout holes and little R. Crumb artwork and back, and it's all of the record album artwork that Crumb has done over his long career. Very first album cover was coincidentally Janis Joplin's first band, Big Brother and the Holding Company, and it's in here as well as all the blues and old-timey and jazz and other artwork that he has done. And it's really a delightful side of Crumb, different from the underground comic Zap artist, as well as different from the Genesis artist as well.
And increasingly cranky.
And lastly, a pair of Disney books. Walt Disney, of course, is famous for Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck, but now they're getting around to doing these wonderful reprints of these classic, this is Donald Duck Lost in the Andes by Carl Barks, who's the real genius artist and creator of all of the ducks for the Walt Disney Company, along with a two-volume set in a box case of some great early Floyd Gottfredson Mickey Mouse comic strip adventures that have been collected for the very first time. And a lot of this has been lost because it was only published in newsprint originally and has never been reprinted in book form until now. And so that's this round for me.
Brilliant, brilliant. Okay, Catherine, back to you.
One thing Ken didn't mention about the R. Crumb book, but I will. This is one of those books where the physicality is really important, and both in the back end and the front end, meaning Once the first run of this is out for the holidays, that's it. It's gone. None of us will probably see it again until after the holidays. So if you want to buy that, you better do it soon because that run will sell out.
Well, it gets back to your idea that the book is an artifact, something, mm-hmm. I mean, that they're paying more attention mm-hmm. to. That's terrific.
Yeah, so segueing into that, Moby Dick in Pictures, One Drawing for Every Page by Matt Kish.
Wow.
This is a doorstop. this is coming from Tin House, I believe. Oh, am I correct? Yeah. Thank you. And Matt, years and years ago, sat down and just started drawing a picture for every page of Moby Dick. These are color or black and white illustrations. They're absolutely fascinating if you are a Moby Dick devotee or if you like to see how books impact somebody's life. Mm. This has been one of those titles that's been kind of percolating in the underground for years and years if people have started to hear about it. And we would get questions at least twice a year. When is that book, Moby Dick and Pictures, coming out? And it finally is out. And it's worth the wait. This, like Yar Crumb, is...
Years?
Boy, I've heard about it for 3.5, 4 years now. Hmm. Takes a long time to do this.
I was going to say, that's amazing, actually.
And again, this is another one of those books that is printed in color, has a lot of devotion to printing. So once the first run is gone, it's gone, and we all get to wait for the next run around. Because these are smaller publishers, too, and they can't just, you know, bankroll with the crap that they publish on the side.
Yeah. Say the name again.
Moby Dick and Pictures by Matt Kish.
Great.
Segueing into fiction, one of the other novels of the year that I really have enjoyed is The Art of Fielding by Chad Harbach. This is a first novel, but it is a novel that took this man a very long, 10 years to write, I guess. There was a write-up in Vanity Fair about it and the process of making the book itself that was absolutely fascinating. For anybody who wants to know why a book costs $23, $25.99, this will help you understand the back-end process. It's not just typing some letters on a page. The book itself is a wonderful story of a man who, ever since he was a child, wanted one thing, and that was to be the best shortstop ever. He spent his whole childhood working his way up to college so he could go into the pros, so he could do this one thing. And he is that one thing, the best shortstop ever, in a small college in the Midwest, until one day there is an accident and it throws him off his game. And after that, his world falls apart. Simultaneously, the world around him falls apart too, somewhat coincidentally and somewhat not at the same time. What I love about this book is not the baseball aspect of it. And when a lot of us heard about this, we thought, oh, it's a baseball book. And I gave it to one of my baseball readers and he didn't like it because there's not enough baseball in it. This book is about characters and it does what fiction does best. It explores the idea of identity. Who am I? What am I becoming? How can I go on now that I am not what I think I am? That whole quest for being is really wonderfully portrayed and plotted in this book. This book is wonderfully paced and plotted. Chad Harbach spent 10 good years writing this book. It's well worth the read. It's well worth picking up. It's called The Art of Fielding by Chad Harbach. The other one, sadly, I left. It's another book that is all about package, and it wasn't obvious to me that it was all about package until I actually got the book. IQ84 by Haruki Murakami. I had to start reading that on an e-reader because that was the way I could get an advance copy from the publisher. And it was kind of disorienting, and I was not able to see the pieces of the package, the typography, the design that Chip Kidd did that made that a remarkable book. And then when I got the book in my hands, it was a totally different story. If Murakami has a magnum opus, and he's still young, so this may be a bold assertion on my part, this is it.
Wow.
1Q84 is, again, an exploration in identity, an exploration of alternative worlds. Things aren't what they seem. It does everything that Murakami does so well, but because it is bigger and deeper and longer, you get to enjoy it so much more than you have in the past if you're a Murakami reader.
1Q84. Great. Betsy Brittner.
I'll just add that if you match that up with the new Umberto Eco, for anybody who likes really abstruse literary thrillers, those two are amazing. I'm going to stay with fiction for this round. A perfect pairing with The Sense of an Ending, I think, is The Cat's Table by Michael Ondaatje. It's another little book. Again, it's about three boys, this time on board a ship. They're on a voyage that's to last 3 weeks, and they're really unsupervised. The narrator, Mina, has a sort of aunt that is supposed to be supervising, but they're really just feral kids, pre-adolescent kids, running wild on this ship. So there is a level at which this is sort of a Mark Twain, sort of a Huck Finn's adventure story. These boys are going everywhere, and they're seeing things they shouldn't be seeing. And, of course, they're interpreting what they see in very different ways from perhaps what they're going to remember later and certainly from what the adults are seeing. So you get these little snippets of what's going on the shipboard from the points of view of these boys. But again, this book is about memory because it comes forward in time, especially through the narrator, and he begins to, as an adult, kind of digest what he's seen and reflect back. So in a much gentler way, it's a book about memory, gentler than the Julian Barnes, not as direct. But it is a beautiful little read, and really, for people who love literary fiction, if you tied these two books together and put a ribbon around them, they're both books that people will never forget.
The Cat's Table, Michael Ondaatje.
Right. Then we have a local writer who has written the same kind of a book. It's called The Voice of the River. It's by Melanie Ray Tone. And she is a novelist who is absolutely a poet. And on one level, this is just an exquisitely tense and heartbreaking read. It's about a young boy, not young, but he's about 17, who's with his dog. His dog leaps through the ice in a river and disappears, and he leaps in after him. And the whole book is about the community looking for these two, hoping to find them, the reader not knowing whether they will or not. But what it becomes, she is a woman who really records the sort of lives of people who are down and out or having a hard time, disenfranchised, all of which sounds hard. But this community of people, as they search and as they come together, she creates a kind of harmony that makes this almost a psalm. I don't even know how she does it. She seems to kind of get into their souls. And it is one of the most beautiful books, one of the most astonishingly beautiful books I've ever read. She is local. She teaches here. She wasn't raised here, but she teaches here, and she is a national treasure. The Voice of the River by Melanie Ray Tone. And then another book that I absolutely loved that came out earlier in the year, and it is at once a literary novel and a breathtakingly good mystery, is Turn of Mind by Alice LaPlante. Mm. I've talked about this book before, and again, it's about memory in a very different kind of way. You are in the mind of a woman whose mind is falling apart. She has Alzheimer's. She's been accused of a crime. There are detectives actually trying to question her. You find out, as these fragments of memory come and go, that she's lost her best friend. And her kids are in this story. Her friend is in this story in memory. The police are in this story, her caregiver, all in the kinds of fragments that I assume someone with Alzheimer's would. This must be the way their mind works. We asked her when she came to town, and she said she wrote this when her mother had Alzheimer's. She, of course, doesn't know what it's like from inside. But one of the things I loved about this book is that it was, in a way, comforting. You know, from outside, when someone you love has Alzheimer's, you only know the pain. From inside, you don't know what you don't know. And when you don't know a thing, you know, the world is what you're seeing.
Blissful, yeah.
Yeah, so in a way it's comforting. It is it's a very intense and well-plotted mystery, one that I kind of defy you to get the answer to. And it is, again, just one of these extraordinarily well-written books, Turn of Mind by Alice LaPlante.
Okay, when we get back from a break, by the way, as we said, all of the titles that we're talking about, and even the ones we don't, get to, which we never get to them all. I should also mention, by the way, that we're going to ask these guys to stick around for a couple of minutes after the show itself, and we're going to tack on a web extra so we can get to as much as we can. But it'll be available, of course, on our website, KUER.org/Radio West. We'll take another brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's our annual holiday book show. We do this every year, of course, during the season. Gather the experts, a group of local booksellers who always have a good feel for that perfect title for those who are looking for the perfect gift this time of year. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us if you like, or our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Let me read a quick email. Someone, James, writes, did you just say local booksellers can sell e-books like Amazon?
We absolutely can sell local books, and we now have our own app to do so.
Okay, all right. Just clarifying, because the subject line was, holy cow. I'm guessing James thinks this is a good revelation. All right, we're on to children's books, and Ken Sanders, back to you.
Doug, this is an astonishing year, I think, for children's books, for illustrated books, graphic novels, and the whole ilk. And there's two giants in the field that have come out with books. But, of course, being the contrarian, I want to go back briefly to old classics first. And I've mentioned these before, so I won't dwell on them. But there are new editions out of possibly my favorite children's books in the world, George MacDonald's The Princess and the Goblin, and its sequel, The Princess and Curdie. They're just delightful. They're a century plus old, and I can't get enough of them. And there is a new edition of a fabulous 70s or 80s Ulderico's The Rainbow Goblins that is really just a visual sensory treat for adults, and maybe kids will like it too. It has lots of pretty colors.
Right.
But what I really wanted to talk about is the brand new, the first in I can't tell you how many years, Maurice Sendak has a new book out called Bumble Arty. And it's just, it's the master at his finest. It's just every single picture in here is like a painting, and it's just all of his delightful characters just at his finest. And it's his first new book in just countless number of years. And another—
Say the name of that again.
Bumble Arty, I believe is how one would pronounce it. And it's just a delightful Sendak book. And another legend who has passed on has issued a brand new posthumous publication, Everything on It by Shel Silverstein, Poems and Drawings by. And it's just, it's as good as anything he ever wrote. This isn't just culls that the family, the estate, and the publisher went through to put out a book. It's just, it's really a great farewell from one of the quirkiest, inconceivable children's books authors, from Playboy cartoonist to best-selling children's books author. Go figure.
Did you? You're going to read something here.
Yeah. We have a. I think we have an audio clip from this book here today, Doug, that I'm going to read. I'm teasing.
Oh,
good, because you frightened everyone.
Yeah.
Control.
We like alarm.
Okay, I'm just going to buzz through these real quick, okay? The intro. Years from now, although I cannot see your face as you flip these poems a while, somewhere from some far-off place, I hear you laughing and I smile. The title poem, Everything on It. I asked for a hot dog with everything on it, and that was my big mistake, because it came with a parrot, a bee in a bonnet, a wristwatch, a wrench, and a rake. It came with a goldfish, a flag, and a fiddle, a frog, and a front porch swing, and a mouse, and a mask. That's the last time I ask for a hot dog with everything.
He's so great.
The genie in the flask. I opened up that magic flask and Zufa popped a genie. I thought he'd be my slave, but no, this genie is a meanie. Instead of filling every wish and doing all my bidding, he says that I must be his slave. And oh, he isn't kidding. I sweat and cough with no days off from Tuesdays until Mondays. I cook his beans and scrub his back and wash his yucky undies and sweep and paint this surely ain't the magic I was hoping. I guess in life it all depends which magic flask you open. And because of the season, Santa's helper. I used to be Santa's helper, but I got fired tonight. Just because I broke the music box by winding the spring too tight. Just because I tried all the bicycles and licked all the candy canes. Just because I dropped those porcelain dolls down from the Tinker Toy crane. Just because I drove the electric train so fast it jumped the rails and wiped that purple finger paint all over the sailboat sails. And just because I squeezed the little stuffed dog till he gave a little stuffed yelp, Santa had the nerve to say I wasn't too much help. And a farewell from Shelley baby. When I am gone, what will you do? Who will write and draw for you? Someone smarter, someone new, someone better, maybe you.
He could do this all day, couldn't he? Ken.
Yeah, he's good.
That's great.
I'm practicing
Grandpa
up from.
Ken.
I have a brand new granddaughter, Lyra, who's. They're not ready for Shel Silverstein, Flynn and Lyra yet. Everything on it, poems and drawings by Shel Silverstein.
Terrific. Okay, Kat.
All right. Chris Van Allsburg is known for his photorealistic illustrations, beautiful, lovely, haunting works, primarily without words. And so this new book, The Chronicles of Harris Burdick, has taken 14 authors to tell some tales that they were inspired to tell by particular drawings of Van Allsburg's. So there are writers in here like Sherman Alexie, Kate DiCamillo, Cory Doctorow on the kind of, you know, edgier side. On the more traditional side, we have Lois Lowry and Jules Pfeiffer. Stephen King is in here, Gregory Maguire, John Sheska. So there are lots of different feels for the stories to accompany these absolutely gorgeous illustrations that Van Allsburg does. The book, although it varies in tone, it never feels like it strays from Van Allsburg's feel and intent of his illustrations. And that's kind of hard to imagine with some of these writers. But, my Lord, they pull it off. It's really a wonderful book. And this is one of those books that's great to have in the house after you've explored Van Allsburg. He's wonderful for several, many years because you can tell stories to the books without being telling the same story night after night. And every person in this room is a parent and knows how awful that can be. But once you're past that point where you've been making the stories to Chris Van Allsburg, you can wrap around to Chronicles of Harris Burdick for story time with your kids and have a delightful time seeing what other people thought and then spring off from it once again and go back. So it's called Chronicles of Harris Burdick by Chris Van Allsburg. Mm-hmm. Next is Grandpa Green by Lane Smith. And this is a very sophisticated book visually. It is a lovely set of illustrations of Lane Smith about a boy who is in the garden with his grandfather who cuts a topiary. And as we wander through the topiary with the boy, he talks about his grandfather and his grandfather's life, what he's done, and what it means to him and what his grandfather means to him. And it is one of those heartwarming, gorgeous tales to give to a new grandparent, to give to a new parent. It's a wonderful thing to read with a child as a child is processing how grandma or grandpa is changing. Do read it yourself the first time if you're a schmuck like me, because you will cry. It's called Grandpa Green by Lane Smith.
Terrific.
Last is a young adult novel, How to Save a Life, by one of my favorite young adult authors, Sarah Zarr. Again, Sarah's strength, I say this every time I talk about one of her books, she writes realistic fiction for teens, not fantasies. And her strength is that she does it by writing to the kids, not at the kids, or down to her readership. So her stories, her characters, everything rings true. This is the story of two girls. Actually, they narrate this story. One of them is a girl who is pregnant, and she finds herself in the home of a woman. And for the first time, there is enough in her life. not just plenty, but enough. You know, there is food, there is shelter, there is love. And the other girl is the daughter of the woman who has brought her into her house. And this is a girl who has had pretty much everything until her father dies. Both of these girls travel down the road of the first girl's pregnancy because her mother has brought them all together with the intent of adopting the child of the girl who never had enough. It's how, again, it's identity. It's how everybody processes who they are and what they're becoming and what they want in the world. All the way through this book, I was wondering, how is she going to resolve this? How is she going to pull this one off this time? And she did reach an ending that felt pretty natural. At first I thought, oh, no, that's weird. But then as we started settling into the ending and she was pulling all the ends together, it worked perfectly. It's a lovely story. Her books are quiet, but they are brilliant. How to Save a Life by Sarah Zarr.
Great. Betsy.
I agree with you. That is a wonderful book.
It works for adults, too. Don't let it turn you off that it's young adult.
Great.
Yeah, she's a fabulous writer. I want to do my kids' books around a theme, the theme being the Museum of Natural History, because it seems to me that what could possibly be a better present than a family membership to the museum, which is so extraordinary, and a book to go with it. So my first book is by Jesse Hartland, How the Dinosaur Got to the Museum. And appropriately enough, the dinosaur in question was found in Utah. It's a Diplodocus. And this book begins with the process of the dinosaur dying millions of years ago, and its skeleton being sort of preserved, and then it skips fast forwards several million years to the dinosaur hunter who discovers the first bone, which is a leg bone, and then the paleontologist comes along and, you know, helps to bolster the discovery, and they bring their crew in and they begin to dig. These are the excavators, and so on and so forth. And pretty soon we have everybody who has anything to do with the dinosaur until it gets all the way to the museum. We even have the museum night watchman in this story. So not only is it informative, but it's colorful and great, and it is perfect to go with a visit to the Museum of Natural History, which we all love.
Say the title again.
How the Dinosaur Got to the Museum, and it's Jesse Hartland.
Great.
Another book that's perfect for this theme is The Magic of Reality. This is a book for the whole family. It's by Richard Dawkins, and the premise of this book is, well, yeah, the supernatural is interesting and chilling and thrilling, and people might think of religion that way, but what is really the most chilling and thrilling and extraordinary is reality itself. So he talks about the creation myth. And then he says, that doesn't even hold a candle to evolution. You know, evolution is so much more interesting. And he does that with every realm of science, from space to dinosaurs themselves. He really covers the entire world that the museum covers. So to me, this would be absolutely the perfect gift to go along with a ticket to the museum. Then leaving the museum, Charlotte's Rose is not a new book, but it is newly reissued. Random House published this several years ago, and, you know, to a lot of national acclaim. And then it went out of print, and the University of Utah has brought it back. It's by Ann Cannon, who, again, we have the most extraordinary group of children's authors here in Utah, and Ann Cannon is one of the best. And it tells the story of a young girl who has traveled over from Wales and then gone on the handcart trek. But what has happened is a woman on the trek died in childbirth, and the father cannot care for a child, so she's 12, and she takes on this child. And that is the heart of the tale. The thing that's wonderful about this book is Charlotte herself has this plucky, funny, irreverent voice. And so you get the whole trek across the prairie in the handcart, but you get it from an irreverent perspective. And is a Mormon, and you get the real inside story, but you also get this plucky, wonderful voice. And like all of Anne's books, it deals with characters in a touching, sometimes funny, but ultimately very real way. Charlotte's Rose. Anne Cannon.
Great. Okay. So we've got about 2.5 minutes left, so we're going to sort of move into a kind of a – we'll consider this last round a lightning round.
Okay.
Catherine, let's start with you. I'm not sure if we'll have time for the reading, but why don't you talk about the one that we were thinking about and then throw in a couple others.
All right. So The Swerve, How the World Became Modern by Stephen Greenblatt. That was great. To be my audio. This is another really fabulous, deep history. And it's history of a couple of things. It's book history as well as classical history. This is the story of a man, he lost his job when the Pope lost his job. So he was sort of a cleric. But he was a book hunter, first and foremost. He was inspired by the Enlightenment and the philosophy, or he was part of the Enlightenment. He was the beginning of the Enlightenment. He was inspired by the classical philosophers, and he went across lots of Europe visiting the scriptoriums and the monastic libraries, trying to rescue classical texts that the Catholic Church was systematically destroying. One day in a library in Germany, he came across the text for Lucretius's On the Nature of Things. And what he found was a book of poetry and a book that explained the universe and a book that provided Lucretius's Epicurean moral code. It's there is no afterlife. You have what you have. Make the best of it now. Enjoy it, which is exactly the kind of book that got burned. He had that book copied, and he began to explore it, and it rocked his world, and it rocked the world of the people around him, as good philosophy does.
Yeah.
Greenblatt is a Shakespearean scholar. He's a classicist in his own right. He's got all the chops to write this, and he has written a book that is just as popular as Will in the World and just as good as Will in the World, only it's taking a look at classical philosophy. The Swerve by Stephen Greenblatt.
Say titles because we're about out of time.
Program or Be Programmed by Douglas Rushkoff. How Music Works by John Powell.
Ken Sanders.
The Utah Phillips Songbook, published by his son Duncan Phillips and myself, Starlight on the Rails and Other Songs, Patti Smith's new childhood memoir following on the heels of the Just Kids with Megalthorpe, called Wool Gathering.
Betsy.
Okay, The Destiny of the Republic, Candace Millard. To me, the absolute best read in terms of history out this year about Garfield and how not an assassin but the medical world killed him. London Under, Peter Ackroyd, which is about the underbelly of London, the crypts and so forth, and fascinating in terms of history and present reality. And A Thousand Voices by our own Jerry Parker. It's a memoir of Jerry and a young man that she befriended, and it's wonderful.
Okay. Betsy Burton, of course, from King's English Bookshop at 15th and 15th. Catherine Weller from Sam Weller Zion Bookstore on Main Street in downtown Salt Lake City, at least for now. Exciting news coming, and we'll talk about that at some point down the line. Catherine, Betsy, thank you very much. Ken Sanders Ken Sanders Rare Books, thank you very much for joining us. As I said, we're going to do a web extra, so these guys are going to stick around and with more books to talk about because we didn't get to any of them yet, just yet. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Hi, it's Doug Fabrizio of Radio West. So it's our annual holiday book show, and we never during the show proper get to as many titles as we like. So we're offering you a web extra. I'm going to spend about 10-15 minutes with our local experts, Ken Sanders of Ken Sanders Rare Books, Catherine Weller from Zion Weller Zion Bookstore, and from Betsy Burton of the King's English Bookshop. And we're going to just work through as many rounds as we can. We're going to start with Ken Sanders.
Okay, Doug. So this is going to be on the web, but it's a radio show, but we're televising it.
Okay. Don't make any sense of it.
I just wanted to get that straight. So without knowing that, I brought my pogo dolls. I brought Pogo Possum, Albert Alligator, and Churchy LaFemme, three of the characters from my favorite. Of course, I have a lot of favorite comic strips in the world, but this is my absolute top favorite.
Got it.
And the reason, I had no idea we were filming today, so I don't know why I brought the dolls, but I did. But there's a brand new series. They're going to republish every one of Walt Kelly's famous pogo newspaper strips in book form. In volume one, they just call it the complete syndicated comic strips, Through the Wild Blue Yonder, from the late 40s, early 50s, Walt Kelly's character Pogo ran for president in 52 under the campaign, I go, you go, everybody Pogo. And then in the late 50s and early 60s, he took on the John Birch Society in a vicious satire, calling them the Jack Acid Society. And he's just made, I wished we really need a Walt Kelly today. Thank God we have Pat Bagley locally, but they don't give him a whole strip to do. Yeah. You know, it's just a one-panel cartoon.
Great. Show that again.
The Pogo characters live in the Okefenokee. They're denizens of the Okefenokee Swamp. And Kelly, most people quoted all the time without knowing that Walt Kelly created two of the most famous phrases in American language. We have met the enemy and he is us. And the other one, if I can get it right, now that we've made the world safe for democracy, who will make democracy safe for the world? He was just a brilliant, brilliant satirist. But his cartooning and his artwork is so luscious. It's just really rich and deep. And it's just these kids absolutely go nuts for Pogo, but they have so many meanings on so many levels. They work well for adults as well.
Great.
Pogo by Walt Kelly.
Brilliant.
We've met the enemy, and he is us. I believe that's Pogo.
Oh, yes,
yeah,
it is.
Yeah. I'm going to revisit something from my lightning round because the book is too important to just be a title. It's Program or Be Programmed by Douglas Rushkoff, 10 Commandments for a Digital Age. This is Rushkoff's manifesto for surviving in an era which is increasingly dominated by experts. Knowledge is fragmenting, and so you can't know everything, right? But you've got to choose what you know. And he begins by saying, yeah, you really should know how to program data. You really should. And people will ask him, why do I need to know that? And he says, well, really, you don't need to know that. But you need to know what's happening on the back end. You need to know what's happening digitally so that you are not at the mercy of digital culture, so you are not at the mercy of the powers that be. He likens it to the difference between, people say, I can drive my car and hire a mechanic. What's the deal there? And what he says here, the difference between a computer programmer and a user is much less like that between a mechanic and a driver than it is like the difference between a driver and a passenger. If you choose to be a passenger, then you must trust that your driver is taking you where you want to go, or that he's even telling you the truth about what's out there. You're like Miss Daisy getting driven from place to place. Only the car has no windows, and if the driver tells you there's only one supermarket in the country, you have to believe him. The more you live like that, the more dependent on the driver you become, and the more tempting it is for the driver to exploit his advantage. That's why you need to know what's going on in digital culture, even if you never pick up an e-book, even if you never have a computer. As we are increasingly being programmed, you need to be aware that you are being programmed. And Rushkoff has a little manifesto that gives you a few steps on how to be aware of those things, on what digital culture is and what it can mean for you on a personal level. Programmer be programmed.
Great. Betsy Burton.
Okay. In keeping with my museum about the Museum of Natural History, the Smithsonian has the most extraordinary book that I think belongs on every coffee table this year. It's called Animal, The Definitive Guide. And if you open it up to any page with your children, for example, you run across all kinds of nasty rodents. You run across bats. You run across the worst kinds of snakes. There are the bats. You run across every kind of vertebrate and invertebrate, birds. You know, everything is here. And not only is this decay in that kind of wonderful color that they use, but there are little snippets each place. So you can sit down with your kid and read something that is short enough for them to listen to. The photographs are just exquisite. And again, there's enough of the gory to fascinate any child.
So critical.
So I think that books like this belong in the living room on a coffee table for adults and children to look at together. The Smithsonian also has done one on natural history that's equally beautiful. I think they're the ideal Christmas or holiday present.
Great. Okay. Let's do three at a time, shall we?
Three at a time?
Yeah, go.
Okay. Well, Doug, we were talking at the beginning of the show about the quality of the books coming out, not just the content, but the physical production of the books. And even larger publishers like Penguin, I only brought one example today. This is a Jane Eyre by Charlotte Bronte. But these, they're doing dozens and dozens of just incredible literary classics in kind of a homage to 19th century bookmaking before the age of dust jackets, when book covers themselves were highly decorated. So it's got this beautifully decorated and pictorial cloth. The bindings are sewn signatures, not glued in. And the paper is quality and acid-free. And it's just a great way to build a library of really beloved classic books. And, you know, any author and classic title from Moby Dick to you name it is in the series, and I really, really like them, and they're coming out with more all the time. And this is an example of something that's coming out from a huge monolithic publisher, not a small publisher. Switching gears entirely, a little Dave Edgar spinoff, and there's a whole bunch of, we just got a whole bunch of new ones in I didn't bring. These little Lisa Brown books, Baby, Mix Me a Drink. And let me just read from the back cover here. It'll give you an idea. These aren't exactly children's books, okay?
Yeah, Baby, Mix Me a Drink.
Baby, Mix Me a Drink. Are you a parent? Are you thirsty? Too many of us allow our infant sons and daughters to lay about idly, napping, drinking milk, and sometimes turning over. Why not have them mix you a cocktail? Thanks, baby.
And baby. Is this a McSweeney's thing? Then?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Baby, get me some loving. And they're really funny, hilarious book. Baby, your parents need to bond. Please dim the lights. Cue up the mute music. And, of course, we got a really old, you know, 50s-style turntable here. Well, I don't have to describe it because you're filming. I'm not used to that.
I know.
Burn some incense. Start a fire, bear rug by the fire, and set out some snacks. Now get in your crib and sleep through the night. Sweet dreams, baby.
Great.
They're just, it's a really, really fun little Terrific. Series.
Do one more.
Oh, okay.
No, not that.
Sorry.
You know, you sorry. Read this as much as okay. I was going
to
read the whole
well,
I'm gonna
go
Silverstein
back to
thing.
Sal Silverstein. Okay. Here's another one. Since we're doing visual, they've started coming out these wonderful retro series of atlases of different areas in 3D, and you get your own 3D glasses that come with the book. Come with got to switch. Pardon me while I switch my glasses. Here. Oh, these aren't made for me. They won't fit. I can't.
There they go.
And there, this is the Salt Lake Valley. Whoa, this is really, wow. I haven't actually done this before. Wow.
It's really amazing,
it really
isn't
is
it?
3D.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
Ooh. Whoa. Doug, you got to try this.
Okay.
That one is really good.
Oh, wow, that is wild.
These are really fun.
Those are even better.
Amazing. Okay, say the name of this. This is...
You say the name. You have it.
3D Atlas of Salt Lake Valley's Tri-Canyon area. That's great.
Very, very good, Mr.
Yeah,
Fabrizio.
With the glasses as well. All right.
And then the other one is the 3D Atlas of Science. Now, I don't think they need to make it work on the sizing. I have a Frankenstein-sized head.
So do I, believe me. Let's say the name of it, though.
3D Atlas of Zion National Park.
Perfect. That's great.
And it's really fun stuff.
Yeah, great. Okay, Kat.
Alrighty then. Extra Virginity, the sublime and scandalous world of olive oil. This is a book that is for...
That's not where I thought you were going.
Yeah, Baby Makes Me a Drink, right? This is a great book about olive oil and olive oil's rise in popular culture. All of us who buy olive oil, we think we're getting extra virgin olive oil. That's what it says on the label. Unless you're buying it from Steven Rosenberg at Liberty Heights, or you're buying it from Tony Caputo, or you're buying it from Frank Granato.
Go local.
Your olive oil's been around It's not.
And you're not even sure it's olive oil. It could be hazel.
It could be seed oil. It could be any manner of things, not what is actually fruit oil. That's one of the really interesting things that was brought home for me. This is fruit oil. Olives are fruits. It goes back to the antiquity and Greeks and the Romans and their dealings with olive oil and olives, and how as the Roman Empire was declining and the Christian Empire was rising, olive oil was really pushed to the side by the lard and butter eaters of the North, because it was associated with a lot of fairly salacious pagan activities, as well as basic hygiene and wellness. That's the other aspect of this. All of the phenomenal uses of olive oil that people have done over the years. They've used
like
it.
Like wrestling.
they still do that now.
Yeah.
conditioning, oil dyeing clothes, washing one's body, tonics for any host of diseases, which chemists are now finding some of those medicinal applications may actually be actual good, efficacious uses of a product. It's a wonderful book. Tom Mueller, the author, is a journalist, so he has that journalist narrow history style. It moves along, it weaves in and out past and present, and yes, it talks about the great scandals in Europe with the Italian oils and the Grecian oils that have been adulterated with assorted seed oils, nut oils, and sometimes things that are even worse than that, that you don't really want in your oil. It talks about the taste of it, and it has actually made me want to drink olive oil just so I know something more about it, and that's saying something because I don't like oil. Extra Virginity, the Sublime and Scandalous World of Olive Oil. The next one is Make the Bread by the Butter, The Tipsy Baker's Guide to the Best Homemade Foods by Jennifer Reese. And I'm sorry, this is an advanced reader's copy because you don't get to see the actual book. Jennifer Reese found herself unemployed, as many people have of late, and she decided to test out this DIY culture. What is it that really is worth it to make, worth it in my life to make? Should I be making my butter? Should I be raising my own chickens and getting the eggs? What about Pop-Tarts? Can I make those? She analyzes it in terms of time spent, materials spent, and satisfaction at the end. There are recipes, the ones she settled on, all through here, and an absolutely delightful writing style. Certainly irreverent. This is not a food tome. This is a fun exploration of food that actually has a use. And the answer to the question is, yes, you make the bread by the butter and you buy the Pop-Tarts, just so people know.
That's expected. All right,
yeah.
Good.
Get the Pop-Tarts.
Yeah.
What am I doing next? Let's do Pacific Crucible. Opposite direction, another huge, big history. This is World War II, War in the Pacific, from 1941 to 1942 by Ian Toll. Toll is another historian who's been around for years and years, who has written books that people know and respect. And he examines the war in World War II, beginning with Pearl Harbor and running through Midway. He talked with a lot of survivors. He's gone back to a lot of source materials. He brings the topic to life. He gives it a slightly new and more lively spin than what people think of when they think of war history. People have a real picture of what war history is.
Yeah.
And I have to say, a lot of times they're right. This is not like that. This is a very good, compelling read. And as that generation is going, and it must be admitted they are, and as the publishing in this particular category shrinks, the necessity of important and good books coming out increases. So I think we're going to see better and better books all the time in war history. This is certainly an example of that. Pacific Crucible by Ian Toll.
Great. Terrific.
Okay, I'm going to start out with some visual books because we are on video. And the first is Sevier, The New Comfort Food. And it is extraordinarily beautiful. But the thing that I like even more is that the recipes aren't very hard. I love comfort food. And one of the things that started me off loving this book was the ultimate grilled cheese sandwich, because it tells you which cheese is the best cheese.
Ooh, which is it?
It's called Comté, and if you can't get your hands on it, you can then use Gruyère, Jarlsberg, or Fontina. They're the ones that melt the best.
Really? Like not crappy cheddar then?
Not
like,
crappy no, cheddar. Okay. No more craft cheese.
We can buy all those cheeses, by the way, here in Utah now.
We I'm can.
Kidding,
yes,
you?
We can. At those, at those vendors that Catherine mentioned.
Yes, exactly.
And so here we have an Italian way to cook shrimp. And again, not, you know, my husband who does all the cooking in our house looked at that and said, oh, that's easy. I can do that. And then again, in New Orleans, there's barbecued shrimp. Ah. So it's recipes that are comfort food, but not just from here, from all around the world. It's beautiful. Here are zucchini fritters. Again, he said he could do this. I'm quite excited about this whole enterprise. So this is a book to give the person in your family who likes to cook.
Great. Perfect.
Then another absolutely beautiful book, this for children, by Sabuda, the most famous paper worker, and Michael Rosen. It covers the nights that they light the candles at Hanukkah with different places in the world where the flame is kept alive, whether it's on a camel, on the deck of a ship. And these are just extraordinary. They're just beautiful. And this is the kind of book you have to give the whole family, because if you gave it to a small child, it would be destroyed in 10 seconds. But it's absolutely magical, page by page. It's unbelievable how they do this. This is a skyscraper celebration.
No, he's
at the end.
Amazing.
He's just a genius. Yeah. So then on a very different note, How They Croaked. This is Georgia Bragg, illustrated by Kevin O'Malley. And, you know, I mentioned very briefly the book about Garfield by Millard. His take on this is, again,
on what?
On Garfield's death.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Is, again, it's not the assassin. It is the doctors. And he describes how the first doctor stuck his hole in the wound. That was just how they started the treatment.
Not the cat?
Not the cat. The doctor.
No. That cat's still alive.
And goes through all the other people who stuck their different devices into the wound. And this goes through every character in history, from Darwin to Queen Elizabeth, telling in kind of lurid and awful detail how they died and why they died in many cases. It's a wonderful book for kids, and again, just the perfect kind of visual book. And just to finish, I want to talk about the Jan Brett, Home for Christmas. She can be uneven in her books, and this is back to the best of Jan Brett. It's about a troll. Trolls, of course, lose their tails by being good, and this troll was never good, and he finally left home and tried all the forest creatures, trying to be taken in by somebody, and finally went home, did good, and lost his tail. Beautiful holiday book.
Great.
Jan Brett, Home for Christmas.
Okay, lightning round. Let's do just like shoot through three. Don't spend too much time with them because we're about out of time, but go for it.
Okay. Betsy briefly alluded to the new Umberto Eco earlier on. It's called The Prague Cemetery, and I think for fans of his novels like Name of the Rose and Foucault's Pendulum, it's a rich read. Mm. Another big author that's come out with a new novel, Jeffrey Eugenides, The Marriage Plot, is also brand new and out. And lastly,
the Pulitzer, that book.
Great writers, great authors. And though it came out earlier this year, and it's not a novel, but our friend Charles Bowden, he paid a Mexican sicario, which is a slang word for a hitman in the Juarez drug cartels, a sum of money to come to a hotel room in El Paso, Texas, and tell him his story. And they camouflaged him, and the guy spilled his guts and stayed all day long. They've made a film out of it that, when it debuted in the Venice Film Festival, half the audience walked out, and the critics universally said that it was an actor and the whole thing had been faked, which is completely not true. This is the book form of it, is a transcript of a Mexican cartel assassin detailing over 200 murders that he committed in and around Juarez.
We're trying to do through the lens about that film and talk about the book, because it is outrageously controversial. I still don't know how I feel about just watching. Cause I don't think it's fake.
No,
but
it's not
how
fake.
Do you feel about watching a person talk about these brutal murders? Which is what's great about film is you wonder, is this even? How do I feel about this? It's terrible. I think it's really, really interesting, and I think that's what you want out of a piece of art is to raise all of those questions.
It's disturbing.
Yeah.
There's no question.
Very, very
Charles Bowden is one of the most fearless writers mm-hmm. working yeah. in yeah. America or the world today.
Great.
Yeah. All right. Van Gogh, The Life by Stephen
Nathy. I know that because we had him on the show. No, we didn't have him. We had
Gregory Whitesmith.
It, again, nice, big, deep biography. But the interesting thing about that one is it reads almost like a magazine article.
It's really good.
It is so well written. It is so well paced. It hits the wonderful points of Van Gogh's life and the very, very low points because, of course, he had both, as many authors do. But I'm sorry, right? Artists.
Yeah.
There we go. As many artists do. But not every artist cuts his ear off. And not every artist is very possibly murdered and has it called a suicide. So it's a great exploration of his art. It's a great exploration of the controversy surrounding his death. And even though it is one of those doorstops that I usually love to carry around that I didn't carry today because it is a doorstop.
It is big. It's almost 900, almost 1,000 pages.
It is almost 1,000 yeah. pages. You will read through it in nothing flat and you'll want to read it again a little while later after you look at
about
his paintings.
Too, though, it breaks down. Like we had them break down Starry
yes,
Night,
yes.
for example. But it gives you a sense of where that came from, that mm-hmm. book, the mm-hmm. context for it, and it will make you appreciate those paintings in a
and
new way.
And that's why when you're done, you want to look at those paintings
yeah.
again, and then you want to go back to the book
yeah.
so you can really let that simmer in and drive home what he's writing and what Van Gogh was trying to do.
Yeah.
Because that's easy to lose in all of the tales and
yeah.
all of the light imagery. One of my deep backlist choices this time is actually a cheat because it's come out as a reissue, and that's The Phantom Tollbooth by Norton Juster.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's had its 50th anniversary this year, so there are many reprints of it. Standard little paperback, a very lovely annotated version of it, and then a very nice anniversary hardcover. This book is so great for kids who are just learning what fun words can be. It is so playful and so clever that adults won't be bored by it either. We're actually reading it for family story time now. We still have family story time when my daughter's 14. And we all sit down at night and we're reading Phantom Tollbooth right now. We just read Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? And right now we're liking Phantom Tollbooth better. It is the fantastic tale of a boy who really... He doesn't want to do a whole lot, but he is one day forced into doing a whole lot by a gift that he's given, a toll booth and a car. And he drives off, he hooks up with a dog called a watchdog that has a watch in it. He ends up going on a quest with a humbug who is probably the prototype for the annoying animal sidekick in all of the Disney movies because you just want him to shut up, but you laugh and laugh at what he says. It is so clever. It is so smart, and it is such a good tale that it's worth revisiting if you haven't read it, and if you have read it, you really should. It's one of those children's classics we all need to read.
Great.
Lastly, Lisa Limpo by Lauren Oliver. This is a great story of, oh my God, we're doing a lightning round.
It's okay.
Sorry, guys.
I don't think you guys understand the concept of lightning round anyway.
No, we don't.
That's okay.
Okay, I'm going for lightning now.
Yeah.
Lisa Limpo by Lauren Oliver. Two lost children who live in terrible circumstances, united by their terrible circumstances, and sent on a fantastic journey by a misdelivered alchemist's prescription.
Wow.
Great. How's that?
Good.
Okay, I'm going to do three mysteries. I always have to do some mysteries.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is The Keeper of Lost Causes, Juicy Alder Olson. And this is for those who like the girl with the dragon tattoo. Mm. This has a very deep and kind of violent part. The main character is a detective who does cold cases. He's been relegated to the basement of the police station. And the cold case he's on is a politician who disappeared many years before. The secret that you quickly learn is that she's still alive, and there are parallel tales. and you can't put it down. It's chilling.
And they've evoked the color scheme.
They did. Yeah. That's a good marketing ploy. Well.
What works? Why not?
Yeah, whatever works. For those who like the piece of the dragon tattoo mystery that is the financial plot, which is actually my favorite part of that, The Wreckage by Michael Robotham is a mystery that goes from the Middle East to Great Britain, and the sort of fulcrum of the whole thing is a financial plot. It, again, is a great read, but, again, it has a very complicated and interesting plot. And then this is somebody I'd never heard of, Jason Webster, or The Bull Kills You. He's Spanish. He smokes too much dope. He drinks too much. But he really is a good detective. He hates bullfighting. The bullfighter who has brought bullfighting back has been murdered in the ring, much like the bulls are killed. The suspects are bull breeders, people who are against bullfighting, his public girlfriend, who is quite infamous, and he has a gay lover. And all of these people are the suspects. It's well written, it's well plotted, and it's a very interesting context. So, Or the Bull Kills You by Jason Webster.
Betsy Burton, Catherine Weller, Ken Sanders, thank you all very, very much. Go to our website, KUER.org/Radio West, for a list of all of these books. Thank you very much.